All right, for those of you listening on the radio, thank you for being here. We're in chapter 68 of Patriarchs and Prophets. If you actually have the book, we're on page 690. This chapter, or these comments that she's about to share, are based on 1 Samuel chapters 29 and 30 and 2 Samuel chapter 1. And here we go. David and his men had not taken part in the battle between Saul and the Philistines, though they had marched with the Philistines to the field of conflict. As the two armies prepared to join battle, the son of Jesse found himself in a situation of great perplexity. It was expected that he would fight for the Philistines. Should he in the engagement quit the post assigned him and retire from the field, he would not only brand himself with cowardice, but with ingratitude and treachery to Achish, who had protected him and confided in him. Such an act would cover his name with infamy and would expose him to the wrath of enemies more to be feared than Saul. Yet he could not for a moment consent to fight against Israel. Should he do this, he would become a traitor to his country, the enemy of God and of his people. It would forever bar his way to the throne of Israel, and should Saul be slain in engagement, his death would be charged upon David. David was caused to feel that he had missed his path. Far better would it have been for him to find refuge in God's strong fortresses of the mountains than with the avowed enemies of Jehovah and his people. I don't know why, but the thought comes to mind. This is the same mindset I believe we should have in regards to firearms. It would be a far better thing to trust in the Lord thy God than in the ability to pull a trigger. I'd rather see the Lord's hand move than a Bible or than a bullet shoot. Why did I say Bible? Once you put your faith in your ability to protect your family, then the Lord steps back and says, okay, fine, that's what you think you have to do. This is your work. This is your decision. You want to take the reins at this point? He gives us free will. You know, I have seen the Lord's hand move in so many amazing ways that for me to put a gun in my house would be an insult to my God. And I would also put a big old, you know, bullseye on my house. Now, there are times, yes, that I've wanted to have a gun because of skunks and whatnot, but prayer gets rid of them too, it seems. You know? How many of us recently, for example, we've shared this. We lost count. I think it was around 51. We did this for like 2 years. We only started keeping track because after it happened a dozen or so times, we started to notice this is repetitive. Whenever a tornado would be headed toward us, because we're in Tornado Alley, and you're on the farms out here. And one of the neat things about being on the farm, you can actually see the tornado coming for miles. So you got a little bit of preparation, unless, of course, it's at night. And we would pray whenever a tornado or an extremely violent storm that could spawn a tornado was headed our way, we'd get on our knees. And the last time we counted, it was at 51. I don't know how many it's been since then. And it's been months since I stopped counting. But 51 in a row, we have seen the storms shift. And I one time recorded a radar thing, just like, you know how the radar shows every 2 or 3 minutes, it shows how the storm's heading towards you. Well, the storm was headed right for us, bearing down right on us, because we put our little town that's near us with a little X on the radar, and it's headed right for us. And as we're praying, all of a sudden the storm shifted northward, and then east. And then when it passed us, it shifted back southern or southward and then east again. In other words, it went up and around us, back down, and then back on its path. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen when I saw that, but I didn't get a chance to record that one. The second one was similar, but it went down and went the other way, and it wasn't as graphic, but I recorded the second one. And so we've seen the Lord's hand move in so many ways, and so this is, you know, putting one's faith in the wrong area is extremely dangerous. And this is, of course, what David is realizing, and Sister White is alluding to here. So continuing. But the Lord in his great mercy did not punish this error of his servant by leaving him to himself in this distress and perplexity. For though David, losing his grasp on divine power, had faltered and turned aside from the path of strict integrity, it was still the purpose of his heart to be true to God. While Satan and his host were busy helping the adversaries of God and of Israel to plan against a king who had forsaken God, that being Saul, of course, and the angels of the Lord were working together to deliver David from the peril into which he had fallen, heavenly messengers moved upon the Philistine princes to protest against the presence of David and his force with the army in the approaching conflict. Now, check this out. This is so amazing. You know, David's, you know how sometimes we pray, says, Lord, we got to have this happen. It's got to go this way or what. You know, we could, three, four, maybe five scenarios we as humans can come up with to get out of a sticky situation. But with our Heavenly Father, he's got an infinite number of ways to get out of sticky situations. And I can't see David coming up with this one. This is so neat. Okay. It says, page top of 691 for those listening on the radio, Patriarchs and Prophets, chapter 68. It says, what do these Hebrews hear? Try the Philistine lords pressing about Achish. The latter, unwilling to part with so important an ally, answered, is not this David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, which had been with me these days or these years, and I have found no fault in him since he fell unto this day? But the princes angrily persisted in their demand, make this fellow return, or in other words, get him out of here. Did he mean go again to his place, which thou hast appointed him, and let him not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he be an adversary to us, should he reconcile himself unto his master? Should it not be with the heads of these men? Is not this David of whom they sang one to another in dances, saying, Saul slew his thousands and David his 10,000s? The slaughter of their famed champion and the triumph of Israel upon that occasion were still fresh in the memory of the Philistine lords. See, this is how the Lord's working here. He's messing with their heads to get them to bless David with a way out of this situation. Let me scroll up a little bit. Okay. They did not believe that David would fight against his own people. And should he, in the heat of battle, take sides with them, he could inflict greater harm on the Philistines than would the whole of Saul's army. It's kind of like being caught in a crossfire, you know? Okay, you're fighting your enemy on one front, and all of a sudden he's behind you. Ain't good. And this is what they were trying to avoid. Because you got to keep in mind, these guys are fighting for their lives. And you're going to look at every aspect. You're going in the war, you're going to look at every aspect. Okay. All right. Going on, thus Achish was forced to yield, and calling David said unto him, surely as Jehovah liveth, thou hast been upright, and thy going out and coming in with me in the host is good in my sight. For I have not found evil in thee since the day of thy coming unto me unto this day. Nevertheless, the Lord's favor thee not. Wherefore now return, and go in peace, that thou displease not the lords of the Philistines. David, fearing to betray his real feelings, answered, but what have I done? And what hast thou found in thy servant so long as I have been with thee unto this day, that I may not go fight against the enemies of my lord the king? The reply of Achish must have sent a thrill of shame and remorse through David's heart, as he thought how unworthy of a servant of Jehovah were the deceptions to which he had stooped. I know that thou art good in my sight as an angel of God, said the king. Notwithstanding, the princes of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us to the battle. Wherefore now rise up early in the morning with thy master's servants that are come with thee, and as soon as you be up early in the morning and have light, depart. Thus the snare in which David had become entangled was broken, and he was set free. Amen to that. After 3 days travel, David and his band of 600 men reached Ziklag. There, their Philistine home, I guess. But a scene of desolation met their view. The Amalekites, taking advantage of David's absence with his force, had avenged themselves for his incursions into their territory. They had surprised the city while it was left unguarded, and having sacked and burned it, had departed, taking all the women and children as captives, which with much spoil. Dumb with horror and amazement, or speechless with horror and amazement, David and his men for a little time gazed in silence upon the blackened and smoldering ruins. Then, as a sense of their terrible desolation burst upon them, those battle-scarred warriors lifted up their voice and wept until they had no more power to weep. Man, that's... Could you imagine that? I don't even want to imagine that. It's not an easy thing to weep like that. She goes on to say that here again David was chastened for the lack of faith that had led him to place himself among the Philistines. He had opportunity to see how much safety could be found among the foes of God and his people. Now, let me stop here for a minute and explain something that's going on. A lot of times people say, well, Sister White throws a lot of her own comments in there, okay, and she's, you know, assuming certain situations. I used to think that as well until I read the book of Esther and then read what Sister White had to say about it. The first time I saw Vashti doing what she did, you know, Queen Vashti that was there before Esther, the king of the day was married to Vashti. And in today's language, he was slamming a couple of brews with his buddies. And he called for his wife to come and stand before his friends because he wanted to say, hey, check her out. Pretty good-looking babe, huh? Vashti, being a godly woman, thought it would be best and thought after her husband sobered up that he would look upon her with favor when she refused his request to come and stand before him and his friends because they were drunk and she knew that had she stood before them, they would have committed adultery in their hearts by lusting after her. That's what Sister White explains. And I, of course, paraphrased it. When you go back into the book of Esther, because I didn't know any of that. When I first read Esther, I just thought, look at Vashti. Is this the beginning of women's lib? You know, I mean, with that male chauvinist garbs I used to have in the old days, I started thinking, what is her problem? I mean, this is the king's wife. You know, what do you want to lose your head? But then I read what Sister White has to say about it, and then I go back into the scriptures and I go, oh, wow, that's right. They were drinking, it says in the scriptures. And it would be sin. We all know what happens when you drink. And it's, so this is, you know, a lot of the times when you see Sister White going off on what some people will call a tangent, if you read what she's saying and then you reread the scriptures that her comments are based on, you'll go, you know, like the commercial, I slapped myself on the forehead going, I should have had a V8. You go, wow, how come I didn't see that before? That's why I like her writing so much. She opens up the scriptures. There's a lot of times we zip, zip, zip right through it, you know? And you shouldn't do that. So anyway, continuing. David's followers turned upon him as the cause of their calamities. He had provoked the vengeance of the Amalekites by his attack upon them, yet too confident of security in the midst of his enemies, he had left the city unguarded. Maddened with grief and rage, his soldiers were now ready for any desperate measures, and they threatened even to stone their leader. David seemed to be cut off from every human support. All that he held dear on earth had been swept from him. Saul had driven him from his country. The Philistines had driven him from the camp. The Amalekites had plundered his city. His wives and children had been made prisoners, and his own familiar friends had banded against him. Not a good day. And threatened him even with death. In this hour of utmost extremity, David, instead of permitting his mind to dwell upon these painful circumstances, looked earnestly to God for help. Okay, let me stop here. For those of us that are going to be part of the Gideon band, or the 144,000, for those of you that don't know what I'm talking about, you're going to deal with this. Guaranteed. There is no doubt in my mind that the scriptures that states the enemies are going to be of your own household is an absolute. I've seen 10 siblings and 2 parents and countless friends and relatives disown me for the ministry that I started back in 1985. Now, many of us have also seen loved ones close by completely look at us as cults or nutcases or preachers on the moon. And you think it's bad now. It's going to get really insane. Now, it may not be immediate family, but it may be friends close by, because you know, not everybody has, you know, so many kids that they got their own zip code like we do here. But you know what I mean? There are some situations where you may have to deal with this. I'm praying that every one of my kids are going to be on our side. You don't know that. I'm not psychic, and I am certainly not a prophet. And so I just trust my God, because I know in his scriptures he says children are, you know, a heritage unto the Lord. And so I trust him with them. But you just don't know. And it's going to get to a point where there's going to be situations where it's going to be intensely, well, just let's just say the word intense, just to leave it at that. Would this not tempt someone to say, look, I think I better get a gun, or maybe I should do this or that or this, you know, whatever. Whatever the case may be, is in other words, step away and try to do something on your own rather than earnestly go to God for help, as David's doing here. She goes on to say that he encouraged himself in the Lord. He reviewed his past eventual life, and boy, that too is powerful. That's one of the reasons I used to have a praise list. I still do have a praise list, but it's not like it used to be in the old days. I used to have a prayer or praise diary where every single day I would fill it out, and I got up to like 22 books. And then I used to get just the big old binders, the fat binders that you get like for school books kind of binders. And I got up to 22 of those, and I finally got to the point where I'm only going to put the big stuff in there from now on. And sometimes big stuff for me is being out in the midday prayer in that little forest the Lord has blessed me with behind my house, and be out there and seeing a butterfly jam its proboscis into a flower. That, to me, could be life-changing. So some people may say that's small, but when I see it, I go, wow. You are absolutely evident in that, not only the flower, but look what that bug just did. And that's just a butterfly, because we got these monarchs that come around here and these hummingbirds, and they like these big sticker bushes, because on the top of the sticker bush, you got this. That's why I like to let the sticker bushes grow, because you get on the top, you got this little, about twice the size of a golf ball, purple little flower, and it's just a ball of little spines. And it's really pretty. And then, boy, the hummingbirds and the butterflies love it. And we'll get a couple of hundred of butterflies before, like towards the end of the season, they're all over the place. You go out there and you're praying, and all of a sudden they're just all over the place. It's just so neat. But looking back when I had these praise lists, because there's a lot of times, I was sharing with a friend on the phone the other day. If I'm not mistaken, he may even be in this room. like Moses, for example, when he went up to the mountain, like Mount Sinai. And Aaron, of course, stayed down at the base. 40 days, absolute silence up there. Do you think there was some soul-searching going on? Well, yeah, I think I would have been doing it. Because there's a lot of times in my life, and in your lives as well, that you'll come to a point in life where it just seems a little dry. Because I remember when I first found Jesus, boy, there was miracle after miracle. You know, as all these neat things were happening and prayers answered and his presence was upon me, you could feel it a lot. And all of a sudden it got to the point where it's just like normal life now. And it kind of like just got silent. And he reminded me of Moses. Because sometimes the Lord will step back and watch his child. Are you going to stay on the straight and narrow, or are you going to think, well, okay, that's it. God's given up on me, so I'm going to give up on him and just go what I want, do what I want, you know? But when you look back, if you got a praise list, or even if you don't have a praise list and you got a good memory, look back and remember all the times that his hand has moved. This is especially useful when you're going through a trial, a massive trial, even especially if it's a financial trial, because if you've had them in the past, and boy, I've had some real doozies, man. I look back and I go, wow, there were times that I thought, you know, I didn't even have two nickels to rub together. Nothing but lint in my pockets. No job, no phone, no car, no prospects, no kidding. And look, 30 years later, I'm still here. Looking back, you see his hand. Looking back, you see answered prayers. And here, it's helping David. She says he reviewed his past eventful life. wherein had the Lord ever forsaken him? His soul was refreshed in recalling the many evidences of God's favor. The followers of David, by their discontent and impatience, made their affliction doubly grievous. But the man of God, having even greater cause for grief, I mean, he had a lot more things to complain about than they did. She says, he bore himself with fortitude. What time I am afraid, I will trust in thee. Psalm 56:3 was the language of his heart. Though he himself could not discern a way out of the difficulty, just like he couldn't a few moments ago, if you recall, you know, when the Lord got him out of that situation with Achish. She says God could see it and would teach him what to do. This is why I always pray for the same discernment or better than King David had, because we're going to come to the day when we're going to be running for our lives when they start enforcing the mark of the beast. You're going to have to know, should I drive down this road or should I hang a right? Because you don't know if there's a roadblock a mile down the road. You got to have that discernment. King David knew. Should I go in this cave or should I go in that one? She goes on to say that sending for Abiathar the priest, the son of Amalek, or whatever, that guy, David inquired of the Lord, saying, if I pursue after this troop, shall I overtake them? The answer was, pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them, and shalt without fail recover all. 1 Samuel chapter 30, verse 8. At these words, the tumult of grief and passion ceased. David and his soldiers at once set out in pursuit of their fleeing foe. So rapid was their march that upon reaching the brook, Besor, which empties near Gaza into the Mediterranean Sea, 200 of the band were compelled by exhaustion to remain behind. But David, with the remaining 400, pressed forward, nothing daunted. Advancing, they came upon an Egyptian slave, apparently about to perish from weariness and hunger. Upon receiving food and drink, however, he revived, and they learned that he had been left to die by his cruel master, an Amalekite belonging to the invading force. He told the story of the raid and pillage, and then, having exacted a promise that he should not be slain or delivered to his master, he consented to lead David's company to the camp of their enemies. Now think about that. The Amalekite just figured, oh, this slave, he's useless. Just let him die. Just drop him off on the side of the road. We'll just be on our way. Because the Lord needed that slave to be there to help David. You know, the Lord will use the wicked to help his people. He created them just like he created us. Going on. She says, as they came in the sight or came in sight of the encampment, a scene of revelry met their gaze. The victorious hosts were holding a high festival. They were spread abroad upon all the earth, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken out of the hand of the land of the Philistines and out of the land of Judah. An immediate attack was ordered, and the pursuers rushed fiercely upon their prey. The Amalekites were surprised and thrown into confusion. The battle was continued all that night and the following day until nearly the entire host was slain. Only a band of 400 men mounted upon camels succeeded in making their escape. The word of the Lord was fulfilled. David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. And there was nothing lacking to them, neither small nor great, neither sons nor daughters, neither spoil nor anything that they had taken to them. David recovered all. When David had invaded the territory of the Amalekites, he had put to the sword all the inhabitants that fell into his hands. But for the restraining power of God, the Amalekites would have retaliated by destroying the people of Ziklag. They decided to spare the captives, desiring to heighten the honor of the triumph by leading home a large number of prisoners and intending afterward to sell them as slaves. Thus, unwittingly, they fulfilled God's purpose, keeping the prisoners unharmed to be restored to their husbands and fathers. All earthly powers are under the control of the Infinite One. To the mightiest ruler, to the most cruel oppressor, he says, hitherto shalt thou come, but no further. Job 38, verse 11. And boy, do we know about Job, right? So I don't care how strong and how many Arnold Schwarzenegger muscles, George W. Bush, or any other high highfalutin government official has to come against the child of God. Hitherto shalt thou come, but no further. No weapon formed against thee shall prosper, it says in the scriptures. If the Lord would have you die that day, it's for his glory. If the Lord would not have you die that day, it's for his glory. If you are his people, his hand's going to move. Going on. God's power is constantly exercised to counteract the agencies of evil. He is ever at work among men, not for their destruction, but for their correction and preservation. And this is why you see the wicked living as long as they do, because he's trying everything he can to get to them. With great rejoicing, the victors took up their homeward march. Upon reaching their companions, who had remained behind, the more selfish and unruly of the 400 urged that those who had no part in the battle should not spare the spoils, the spoils, that it was enough for them to recover each his wife and children. But David would permit no such arrangement. "Ye shall not do so, my brethren," he said. With that which the Lord hath given us, as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff. They shall part alike." Thus the matter was settled, and it afterward became a statute in Israel that all who were honorably connected with a military campaign should share the spoils equally with those who engaged in actual combat. Try to find a military that does that today. Besides recovering all the spoil that had been taken from Ziklag, David and his band had captured extensive flocks and herds belonging to the Amalekites. These were called David's spoil, and upon returning to Ziklag, he sent from the spoil presents to the elders of his own tribe of Judah. In this distribution, all those were remembered who had befriended him and his followers in the mountain vastness when he had been forced to flee from place to place for his life. Their kindness and sympathy, so precious to the hunted fugitive, were thus gratefully acknowledged. It was the third day since David and his warriors returned to Ziklag. As they restored their ruined homes, they watched with anxious hearts for tidings of the battle, which they knew must have been fought between Israel and the Philistines. Suddenly a messenger entered the town with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. He was at once brought to David, before whom he bowed with reverence, expressing recognition of him as a powerful prince whose favor he desired. David eagerly inquired how the battle had gone. The fugitive reported Saul's defeat and death, and the death of Jonathan. But he went beyond a simple statement of facts. Evidently, supposing that David must cherish enmity toward his relentless persecutor, the stranger hoped to secure honor to himself as the slayer of the king. With an air of boasting, the man went on to relate that during the battle, he found the monarch of Israel wounded and sore pressed by his foes, and that at his own request, the messenger had slain him. The crown from his head and the golden bracelets from his arm he had brought to David. He confidently expected that these tidings would be hailed with joy and that a rich reward would be his for the part that he had acted. But David took hold on his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even for Saul and for Jonathan, his son, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. The first shock of the fearful tidings passed. David's thoughts returned to the stranger herald, in the crime of which, according to his own statement, he was guilty. The chief demanded of the young man, "Whence art thou?" And he answered, "I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite." And David said unto him, "How wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Twice David had had Saul in his power, but when urged to slay him, he had refused to lift his hand against him who had been consecrated by the command of God to rule over Israel. Yet the Amalekite feared not to boast that he had slain the king of Israel. He had accused himself of a crime worthy of death, and the penalty was inflicted at once. David said, "Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth hath testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed." David's grief at the death of Saul was sincere and deep, evincing the generosity of a noble nature. He did not exult in the fall of his enemy. The obstacle that had barred his access to the throne of Israel was removed. But at this he did not rejoice. Death had obliterated the remembrance of Saul's distrust and cruelty, and now nothing in his history was thought of but that which was noble and kingly. The name of Saul was linked with that of Jonathan, whose friendship had been so true and so unselfish. The song in which David gave utterance to the feelings of his heart became a treasure to his nation and to the people of God in all subsequent ages. And of course, that's from Samuel chapter 1, verses 19 to 27, where it says, "Thy glory, O Israel, is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew nor rain upon you, neither fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, as of one not anointed with oil. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives." Listen to these words, by the way. He knows Saul hated his guts. But that doesn't matter. He loved Saul. It's just like Ephesians 6 tells us. We're not fighting against flesh and blood. We're fighting against principalities. David knew this. Had Saul known the truth, he wouldn't have done the things he'd done. So he's just bringing to remembrance all the good things that Saul did. Going on, it says, "And in their death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet delicately, who put ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan is slain upon the high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished?" With that I say amen.